You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Why don't I start with introducing our speakers then. Asma, who's to come on, obviously, is the chair of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, and she's also UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion. She, in addition to those identities, is a very well-known Pakistani human rights lawyer. She is a board member of the OSI's International Board, the International Crisis Group, and as you know, she's been under she's put under 90-day detention by the military authorities on Saturday, just about almost 2 weeks ago. She advised me early this morning when she called that she's being allowed for the first time to have visitors from outside, in addition to those people who were remanded to her home stroke sub jail. And so these are going to be the first people from the outside, and unfortunately they're going to be visiting her at some point, unexpectedly, it turns out, during the period of our call. And so she's going to, we'll give her the floor first, and she will say what she can, and then we're going to hear from our other three speakers, and we will try to maximize the time for Asma on the air as long as we have her. But that's just by way of warning that we may not have her for the full period until 10 o'clock, such is the situation. We're also very fortunate to have with us from Boston Professor Aisha Jalal, from professor of history from Tufts. She will speak immediately after Asma. And then on my right is Anil Kahan from Fordham, and he will speak third. And finally, we'll have Rick Barton from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who recently, together with Karen von Hippel, wrote a report, which was, I think, the first one really to document and name the $10 billion number, which has been now referred to very frequently as being the amount that the U.S. They've been able to track the U.S. assistance since 9/11 to Pakistan, and he will talk a little bit about the U.S. Role and their options in all of this. But Asma, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We understand the constraints for you, and so there we therefore it's tremendously important that you're here. We'd like to ask you to have the first word in today's forum, and talk for a few minutes about how the situation is evolving, and also your views about what needs to happen now. Asma, would you like to talk now for a few minutes, and then we'll hope to make this as interactive as possible.
Thank you very much. First of all, I think I should thank all of you for the support. I believe that each one of us here is such, because I think this is the first time that people outside of Pakistan have been supported a democratic federal movement. The situation there is as follows, that there are pockets of rallies. It's not widespread, it's not as though everybody in the public has come out. And one of the reasons, of course, is that there are hundreds of people who have been arrested, mostly those who are capable of meeting or getting people together. Nevertheless, today there was a huge rally of students in Lahore. There was, again, something in Peshawar, in Karachi. So it is in every city of Pakistan that it is the government has been able to contain it. It was not from the black lawyer movement, they brought thousands and thousands of people in the street. On the political side, Then it makes me feel ever since she gave this statement yesterday, saying that she can't work with the sheriff, there is vigorous diplomacy to bring her back on the table with him. On the other hand, the political, other political opposition parties have very categorically said that if she goes back this time, that they would have to sever all connections with her, and she must take the vote to give their support to her. Ben Briggs called me up yesterday, and we were talking on the phone, and he was coming to mention that I raised this after they had done it. Now actually, they were able to talk back, because previously when I was talking to them, they had absolutely said, after they had done it, said, I really don't want to touch her anymore, because every time we had done it, she turned her back on us. So it took some persuasion on everyone's part, I think, to bring this consensus on the table. I don't know what has happened today, because mostly my landline has been out of order, and this phone has also been waking up from time to time. So I don't know what has happened. I believe that they are now talking to each other. Akhrasa Patek, who was arrested yesterday, has been released today, and possibly will come to the board tomorrow. So we guarantee something, there are some talks about some communication in that direction. Other than that, it is very confusing. People are waiting for Major Pointer to come. People here obviously think that it is the Americans that are micromanaging everything. That is one of the reasons a lot of people have said, what is the point of coming out in the streets? Because eventually, into Washington, that will decide what will happen. Nevertheless, there are also there is also information, as much as I can get sitting here, that people around him are still very nervous. And he himself appears to be more and more nervous because he knows this can't keep all of us in jail forever. And the minute he lets some of us out, riots will start again. And they are not ending by any means.
Okay.
But lastly, let me just emphasize that there was a consensus yesterday when I was on the phone talking to all of them, and that is precisely the reason that my phone probably is being often on disconnected today, that there has to be a government of national reconciliation with all parties on board, or most parties on board, before elections can be held. Otherwise, if there will be big elections, there will be more trouble, it will simmer all throughout, and there will never be a kind of peaceful settlement as such.
Asma, thank you very much. I wondered if you would also like to add a couple of words about the international reaction. You mentioned about Washington. Yesterday, the Commonwealth issued their reaction. I was wondering whether you could talk a little bit about the international reaction beyond Washington and some things that you would like to see happen.
Statements of concern, many of us welcome this very much. Nevertheless, there is a part of the loyalist leadership that did call me up expressing concern because it has, that it has left out the whole issue of reinstating the judiciary. Now, there is some concern here that the international community, when they do talk of elections, they do talk of relieving political prisoners and human rights activists, that they are a bit silent about the judiciary. My impression from the few people that I've met, which are being ambassadors, is that they also have reservations about the Chief Justice. The final element, the most balanced, I would say, the most reconciliatory, rather than that, I should say thinner, reconciliatory section of lawyers are saying, well, what about the other judges? So even if there is a reinstatement of the judiciary, the bar leadership should get active into explaining to the Chief Justice that perhaps he needs to step down voluntarily and, you know, offer him or persuade him to take on something else, which is possible. according to them. There is another section of lawyers that is saying they absolutely will not agree that the Chief Justice be guillotined in all this, whereas the allegations against him have been absolutely incorrect. Nevertheless, the Chief Justice has the reputation of being a loose general sometimes, so there is fear in the international community how a new democratic process will deal with this Chief Justice who's here for many years. There is also a section of lawyers that believe that once he's reinstated again, it is very difficult for him now to take up unnecessary issues, and he can be explained to, he can be told that these are your areas and you should not go beyond that. So I don't know how that will work out. And this is one of the reservations about people regarding the statements of the international community. Other than that, as everybody has seen, that there has been a shift, there has been a change, and people are very hopeful when they, particularly after the Commonwealth statement.
Thank you, Asma. We're going to come back to this. I'd like to give the floor next to Aisha Jalal, and she'll talk for a couple of minutes, make introductory statement. We'll go to all of our speakers to let them make introductory statements, and then I and the audience, obviously, will be asking questions.
Is this working?
Yeah, it should be.
Hello? Yeah. Hi, Asma.
Hi, Ashley.
I just want to sort of, first of all, say that in addition to Asma, there are thousands of human rights activists, lawyers in detention, and Asma is under house arrest, whereas people like Itezaz Essen, who was of course the foremost lawyer, is somewhere in a jail, living in a solitary cell. And so we really sort of need to condemn this in outright fashion. These people need to be released right away. Having said that, I just want to say that it's not for the first time in Pakistan's history that the coercive apparatus of the state has decided to cleanse the streets of Pakistan of peaceful demonstrators and hurl them into jail. What is different, of course, is that on this occasion, instead of the political parties being the main targets, it's members of civil society, human rights activists like Asma Jahangir, lawyers like Itezaz Essen, judges who are the main target of a state and a government that are fighting, supposedly, extremism. And we're trying to create a broad-based alliance of moderate and liberal forces. Now, those forces are in jail, and the extremists are running amok in the northwestern regions of Pakistan. So that's something that has to be really underscored, the fact that the judiciary has been simply been annulled by a stroke of the pen because the president's election could not be revalidated, is, I think, a telling statement on the state of affairs, which are being presented as a serious a crisis related to terrorism, where it's clear that it's a question of the perpetuation in power of General Musharraf. A lot has been said about judicial activism. The fact, of course, is that the very constitution that he claims to be upholding does not permit his continuation in office, and that has been a problem. And this is something that he ought to have been aware of long before this crisis has come to a head in recent weeks. So we don't really understand what he means by judicial activism as far as his own particular perpetuation in office is concerned. There's simply no way that the Constitution can be interpreted to allow him another term. He can only do that through coercive power, which is what he's doing. But unfortunately, that has, for the first time in Pakistan's history, we are seeing civil society showing resistance. Political parties are more divided than ever. That's also a product of extended periods of military rule when fragmentation of the political opposition follows naturally. But what we are witnessing is resistance from lawyers, from human rights activists. Students have joined in as well. And that is heartening. And one can assume that this is going to be a long, drawn-out battle, which can only result in one sort of solution, and that would have to be a peaceful a transition where there is a restoration of at least part of the judiciary. I mean, Asma was commenting on who may have to be excluded, but you can't just write off judges and appoint hand-picked judges and then get yourself revalidated. I think that is something that will be much more difficult for the general to get away with on this occasion. Of course, there are things to be said about what the international community can do. Asma has mentioned what the Commonwealth has done, but we know from past experience that the general is not particularly swayed by what the Commonwealth does. In 1999, Pakistan was thrown out of the Commonwealth and was eventually reappointed, readmitted in 2004. So the Commonwealth is not going to, I mean, it's heartening for human rights activists and civil society elements who are protesting the emergency, or the martial law more precisely. But I think that more would have to be done by the United States of America. We hear that Negroponte is going out. We don't know what exactly he's going to convey to the president other than to say to lift the emergency before the elections. But I do think that what really ultimately will matter to the general is elements around him, i.e. his own army. And if he is seen, as people are increasingly beginning to see, that he is becoming a liability rather than the asset that he believes he is, then I'm afraid that the army will eventually have to decide whether Pakistan is more important than the continuation in office of President Musharraf.
We're going to go to Anil and then to Rick in Washington.
Okay, thank you. I want to just pick up on this focus on the judiciary and in particular talk about this idea of emergency versus non-emergency. I think at this point, a couple weeks in, this is relatively clear to a lot of people that we're not really talking about a situation of emergency. Emergency is a constitutional construct whereby certain provisions in the Constitution can be suspended by the president, not all. There's a significant role to be played by Parliament. There are time limits that would be involved in that kind of regime. Now, and I don't mean to suggest that constitutional emergency is any picnic. There are a lot of problems that can arise under constitutional emergency. But this is clearly not that. This is a situation where the Constitution has been held in abeyance altogether. The proper legal construct within which to understand that is treason. Abrogation of the Constitution by force or coercion is an act of treason under the Pakistan Constitution. And presumably that's why several justices of the Supreme Court chose to follow their existing oaths by suspending Musharraf's proclamation of so-called emergency and chose to not adhere and take a new oath of office to his provisional constitutional order. Now, we could just understand this as a matter of semantics, but I think that the semantics involved are actually shaping the nature of a lot of the international responses and media responses to the situation. Emergency implies something that can be, as the language goes, lifted. Implies a response to a temporary expediency involving temporary measures to which then at a certain point a return can be possible to the status quo as it existed before the emergency was put into place. That isn't really what this is all about. As Aisha and Asma have already indicated, there is a more fundamental mental transformation of institutions that is being sought here, in particular the judiciary, but through this also, I would say, media, a more permanent transformation, not simply in a temporary restriction of what media actors can say and do, but a more permanent code of conduct to restrain how media function going forward. And similarly, we could look at the other institutions of civil society as well and look at independent political parties, bar associations, NGOs. This is simply an effort to weaken the ability of these actors to function not in a temporary period of time during which some expediency is being addressed, but in a permanent way going forward. I don't even know what it would mean to say that this state of emergency would be lifted. That's not a meaningful way to understand this, which is why the focus on the need to reinstate the judiciary is an important one. The discussion that has taken place in the last 2 weeks, I think maybe shifting a little bit this week, has focused exclusively almost on the need to ensure that elections take place on time. And I say this, the discussion in the United States. the need for elections to take place on time, to some extent the need to get people out of detention. These are obviously of critical importance. I don't mean to underestimate that at all. But to focus exclusively on keeping elections on track, to focus exclusively on the right to life and liberty is an inadequate long-term response. Because, of course, first of all, those elections must be free and fair to be meaningful, and whether we can count on that, that's an issue we can talk about in the environment in which this permanent transformation is taking place. But in the long term, I would also say that these institutions are not simply important to check military rule. They're important to check civilian rule. And you know, a lot of the critiques of the period during the 1990s, Musharraf himself refers to the period as the dismal decade of democracy for Pakistan. And there's no question that there were, you know, were issues that arose during that civilian period of civilian rule. But I would argue that any meaningful transition to democracy, and Musharraf speaks of his three phases, would require these very institutions to be strong. And by undermining them now, what may be at risk is a return to a period of a transition to a democracy that is an incomplete transition. So I think I'll just leave it there. And
thank you. We're going to go to Rick because...
I absolutely agree with what Rick said. Mm-hmm. Absolutely agree.
Thank you.
Thank you, Asma. And these are subtleties, obviously, which are being very much lost at the high political level. Do you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to add just a hint of encouragement about the reaction in the United States. And this is simply, I think the governmental response has been inadequate to the point of being at times incoherent. But there are signs of encouragement. USMA's call last week for bar associations around the world to respond has been heeded. And yesterday, I don't know how many of you were able to be there or to see the news about the response by the New York City and New York State bar associations. We had several hundred lawyers on the steps of the main courthouse downtown making this very point, that it's not simply about getting elections on track, that this is an assault on the judiciary, and that any meaningful transition must restore that. And today there is a similar response in Washington. There have been other responses around the country. So just wanted to add that note of encouragement as well.
Yeah.
Can I just ask something?
Please.
This is actually a turndown on the entire civil society of Pakistan. Whether it's the independent judges, whether it's independent media persons, whether it's human rights, whether it's lawyers. And General Musharraf has not taken one step back after having declared his martial law, and it's true that it's not just emergency. He has come up with two laws, which are very significant. The first is the amendment to the Army Act. And if you look at that amendment, it's horrifying.
Yep.
Because anybody who even says that there are more than one nationality that that is in Pakistan can be tried under the Army Act. The second is the Legal Taxation Act, where my license as a lawyer can be extended by the new courts that are there. So he takes the courts with his own judges, controls the lawyers through them. And this is very careful. That is why lawyers find now, and a lot of people who have been writing and saying, that this is a moment either we break it or we have broken down ourselves.
Thank you, Asma, for that. I want to go to Rick, because so many of the speakers are referring to what's going on in Washington and how it's not only its response, but indeed the whole pattern of Washington's cooperation with Pakistan has evolved, particularly over the past year since 9/11. Rick, are you there?
I am there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Okay, Rick, why don't you go ahead then and speak a little bit about the view of how Washington is managing the relationship and how it's reacted in the current crisis.
Well, I think Washington is a bit more confounded and less sure of itself than perhaps the feeling on the ground in Pakistan suggests. I would say that there's clear awareness of the increasing isolation of Musharraf and in turn his allies here in Washington. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a split within the administration, probably with Vice President Cheney and and the Pentagon, not so much Secretary Gates, but sort of the traditional relationship on one side, and a subtle shift taking place in the State Department that is beginning to recognize that we at least have to speak to a alignment with the Pakistani people. And so you've seen that, but I don't think you see that developing, but that has not yet shaken out in a singular policy. I do think there's a sense of powerlessness in terms of our information, our awareness of what's going on, the thinness of our contacts into a society that's as rich and large as the Pakistani society, and in turn, nervousness about the continuing nervousness about the Afghanistan border operation and the terrorism in the country. So the issue of what this, where does this go to? The first response, I think, has been rather predictable, and it's the usual onward with the elections, condemnation, let's get Musharraf out of uniform, release people from prison, fight terrorists, send high-level visitors. We're continuing to plan our $100 million of new spending in the Northwest, and there's still people talking of the power sharing. So my feeling is that almost all of those kind of first responses have already been overtaken by events or will be soon, and we will find that my suspicion is that things will move a little faster than rather than the long drawn out battle. I think there will be that, but there will be probably a much faster series of events with the Pakistani military recognizing that Musharraf is too much of a liability, and he puts all of their other holdings and operations in the country at risk, and that they'll try to respond with a kinder, gentler face. So the U.S. policy has not yet moved to anticipating this, but I think it does need to move in the direction of recognizing that Musharraf will be there somewhere between 10 minutes and 10 months, and that to be in a stronger position, we're going to have to align ourselves with the people, show that we're willing to move our funding, which is now way out of bounds, into a position where it is seen as being more direct benefit to the people. We obviously have to take on the judicial issues, because the restoration of a rule of law culture in Pakistan is central to its progress, and the U.S. should express that, including fair trials for people that have been accused of corruption, and then to recognize that something like a government of national reconciliation would be a very, very high-end, a very positive high-end result from this crisis, and probably the best way for a peaceful transition. I don't think that realization is yet filtered through. It is the subject of conversation in some places, but it is clearly not the administration's view at this time.
Asma, are you there? Hello, Asma?
I think we lost her.
We might have lost her. I'd like to open the
floor. Could I just respond to a couple of things that were said? I just want to say that, first of all, the issue of the emergency being lifted and the problems that poses in terms of the general and treason that you mentioned, and we know from history, from Pakistan's history again, that we've had this problem before, from the 73 Constitution onwards. I mean, General Ziaul-Haq waited a very long time, and the only way he could lift his martial law was after indemnifying it. So I don't see how this emergency / martial law can be lifted without the general getting an indemnity, either from a parliament which is going out tomorrow, or the next parliament. So that has to be kept in mind. So there is a problem between the 10-minute and the 10-month issue here. The second point that I really want to lay out is that, given what's been happening, there is simply no choice. The actions he has taken, because there is no way that he can perpetuate himself legally, he's had to undertake these extra constitutional measures to remain in office. His army is clearly supporting him, and so long as his army supports him, it's going to be very hard, even if you fill the jails with 10 times as many people, to persuade the general that what he's doing to perpetuate himself is wrong. And I do think that needs to be thought about very, very carefully, about the implications for civil society or what remains of that. And finally, the issue about the government of national reconciliation. I think this was what was being attempted in a sense by trying to create this nexus between Musharraf and Benazir, which was widely criticized in Pakistan. I frankly think that with this emergency/martial law, the possibility of a government of national reconciliation, so long as Musharraf remains, is very difficult. So short of resigning, I don't see how this is going to be resolved very soon or very quickly with any degree of mutual satisfaction to both sides. So this is going to be very bloody and going to be very difficult to persuade the general to sort of basically quit. The only thing that I can see is for there to be something similar to what I think some of my friends who know Pakistani history will remember happened with General Ayub Khan, when his own chief of army staff, Yahya Khan, basically asked him to step aside. So other than that, I don't see how this is going to be resolved.
Isn't that the most likely next step?
Yeah, I think it is, but the army has to act. So what I'm trying to suggest is, in terms of where the pendulum is it with civil society? I mean, I think the pressure is there, but I don't think, I mean, just reading even what he has to say to the New York Times today suggests that the general is just not ruffled by what's happening outside. He's only going to be concerned about his own army, how his army is reacting.
My sense of the scenario then will hasten the army's action, because I agree with you that I think that's where it is likely to happen, is that there will be, at some point, significant street demonstrations, because in a way the actions of Musharraf up to now have suppressed that and are creating a greater pent-up demand for it. So there will be huge public demonstrations at some point, because they cannot be dampened forever. He will start to liberalize, because he has to suggest that he's got a kinder, gentler face. Then the street demonstrations result. Then you end up with some kind of a disaster, at which point the pressure on the other generals is just too great. That's the most likely scenario, and I think in that case they have to sacrifice him, because they will want to save themselves and their institution and their holdings. And so it's not that it's going to be fast or that it's going to be pleasant, but I think it will be a combination of the public, of the street, and the generals moving, and then the result might be a government of national reconciliation. That would be a very high-end result.
I'd like to open the floor. Thank you, Rick. I'd like to open the floor to questions. I mean, I just want to say on this government of national reconciliation, I think we're talking about more than Benazir and Musharraf.
No, I mean,
we're talking about all
parties. I was just implying that this national reconciliation government probably cannot include Mr. Musharraf anymore, is what I'm
saying.
Yeah. Maybe a month ago, but it seems that, you know, we're in full crisis mode now, where basically anything can happen if we're lucky. Now, I wanted to open the floor to questions and invite people to just speak into the mic, as I explained for those of you who are here at the outset. The reason is that listeners on the participants from remote won't be able to hear you if you ask your question from your seat. And second, the event is going to be broadcast on our website. So I was wondering if anyone would like to ask a question, make a comment. Yeah. And just kindly identify yourself for the benefit of the speakers.
This is Sandy Colliver. I'm from OSI. I'm interested in hearing more about Benazir Bhutto and whether she's able to redeem her credibility. Is she with Musharraf? Is she absolutely against him? And more broadly, I mean, will charges of corruption be suspended against her if you're moving towards a government of national unity that's built on the rule of law? Does there, what will be the approach to corruption and amnesties, and who else would be included in a national unity government?
Thank you.
Well, in terms of credibility, I think the ultimate sort of deciders, I mean, those who will decide whether she has credibility or not, are going to be the electorate when and if and when they are allowed to cast their votes. I mean, of course, they are the chattering classes who are annoyed with her, first of all, for agreeing to sort of broker a deal, so-called, with Musharraf. There are those who are upset with the National Reconciliation Ordinance, and that, of course, a petition was put into the Supreme Court. So all these issues are there, but I think that the credibility issue, I mean, she has, of course, now said that she's not prepared to do any sort of, have come to any sort of agreement with Musharraf. He has to quit. That's a big step for Benazir. Whether that is sufficient to restore credibility with elements that have been criticizing her, I doubt it very much. But I do think that the elections will ultimately decide how much credibility Benazir Bhutto has. And I don't think that simply determining which section of society speaks about her credibility or lack of matters very much at this stage. Everybody in Pakistan is tainted in some way or the other. Whether her corruption charges can be lifted, I mean, the question, of course, with the National Reconciliation Ordinance is that it relates to cases not including the ones that she is really in a fix with. I mean, the Swiss case, the Spanish case, and the one at the Surrey. There are about four or five cases that are beyond the National Reconciliation Ordinance. But I do think that any case that has been covered by the NRO is because some of these cases have been going on for 10 years and they have not managed to prove them. And I don't see why, even with the NRO, if it were to sort of become law, which I now doubt very much, people cannot bring charges against her and prove them in the courts. So I think that this will continue to haunt her for a bit, her cases. I think that she will have to decide for political reasons what she wants to do with these cases once and for all. But I do think that you cannot take away from the fact that the woman is a real politician. She is somebody with an electoral base of support. And unfortunately in Pakistan, this tendency to decide whom to throw out, whom to keep in, I mean, this artificial sort of kind of process, that has been the bane of the country. It is only when people themselves can vote politicians out for their lack of competence, for their lack of accountability, that things matter. The reason why Pakistanis supposedly cannot throw up new leadership is precisely because the electoral process is never completed. No government since 1985 has been able to complete its term in office other than the one that the general so proudly boasts, the one in recent times has completed its term. But the fact is that it's Benazir was thrown out twice, Nawaz Sharif was thrown out twice, and the only way these things are going to be resolved and whether or not people think she's credible or not is going to be through an electoral process. And here I might add that if you look at the great democratic society of India and you look at some of the politicians there who keep getting elected despite their corruption. So I think that's the word of warning for you in terms of how the general public views these cases and her credibility issues.
I would just add that I think she has that she certainly has a popularity, but whether her credibility is going to require her to grow politically in ways that she has not shown historically or even upon her return. I think she's been slow to embrace the lawyer movement, even though it has come from within her own party to a great extent. She's shown that she's excessively U.S. dependent, and I think she was probably not sensitive enough about the incredible loss of life upon her return. So that she has not opened up her own party, and she hasn't really shown that she's willing to play by the Constitution. So those will all be tests of her political development. And her political, I do think that it's important for Pakistan for her to continue to grow as a politician. She is relatively young. She's in her mid-50s. And it would be good for her to show that there's additional strength within her party, and there are other talents that she could bring along and transfer her popularity too. So Those are all, I think, will be the measures of her growth, and it would be great to see somebody continue to grow rather than rehashing old fights.
Thank you. There's some other people who wanted to ask a question. Manaz, did I see that you were... Maybe if you...
So could you ask the question?
If you ask, well, if you ask it just at the microphone, it's...
Most of my question, Manaz Isfahani, most of my question was answered, but Benazir also faces some constitutional hurdles, even if she does run for election. That, and how would you address those?
Let me...
Yeah.
Yes, there are constitutional hurdles because the term was never completed. And so I do think that this can... I mean, if there's an elected parliament, this can be discussed in parliament. But I remember talking to Benazir some years ago when she told me that she didn't want to be prime minister at all. She wanted to be president. So, whether she's forgotten that or she just said that in a moment of jest, I don't know. But it's always occurred to me that considering this problem that she faces with the two terms, incomplete albeit, that maybe she'd want to become president. Who knows?
Although I could just add, there's a little bit of an Alice in Wonderland quality to having General Musharraf raise that issue, of course, because there's no constitution in place right now except what he says is the constitution today or tomorrow. I mean, he is suspended and held it in abeyance.
Yeah,
of course. But in the New York Times yesterday, he raised this issue, which I find somewhat ironic.
Yeah. Rick, would...
I would just say I think the Constitution is more likely to come into play after this crisis is resolved, that it is such a jumble at this point that it's unlikely to provide great clarity for these next few months.
Good. We have another questioner.
My name is Mona Patel. I'm a student at City University of New York Law School. And my question is more general. We've mostly heard of the legal community's reaction to Musharraf's recent actions. What has the general public's view been on it, and how will that affect if there is still an election that takes place in January, February, whenever it does? Will the general public be affected by these raids and Musharraf and fear of voting against him?
I'm sorry, but may I just take that? First of all, I think that Asma mentioned the fact that the demonstrations had not been nearly as large as you might expect, but I think it's a fallacy to think that just because state coercion keeps people off the streets, or a sense of disenchantment with the political parties, the political leadership, keeps people at home, that this is a sign of support for the general. I think there's a growing sense of frustration. There has been rampant inflation in Pakistan. There are lots of other issues that had been leading to his declining popularity since, of course, most noticeably March of this year. But I think that this emergency has, in a sense, been the final act of the general. For whatever reasons, and I think one has an idea what the reasons are, I do think the public will vote if the opportunity is given. But clearly, no election can be held under martial law. That will have to go. Otherwise, it has no credibility. I don't believe that the political parties, including, I think, PPP, Benazir's PPP, would be minded to fight an election under martial law. So that may well be a non-starter. For the general. He's trying that. He would like to keep martial law in place while he goes to the polls, but I'm not sure that that's going to help. But as for support, genuine support, I do think that other than those very, very small quarters who have done very well out of his rule, let's face it, there has been a lot of prosperity for certain segments of Pakistani society, and they, of course, continue to support him. And they will continue to support him, but for the vast populist, because the general was not a populist. I mean, he was not pursuing economic policies that would make him terribly popular. He was primarily fixated on improving Pakistan's macro indicators, in which he had some success. But there are many micro indicators that remain startling. for Pakistan, including the poverty, the increase in poverty. And he, of course, his excuse is to give me another 5 years and I'll fix those too, but it looks unlikely. So I think that we must not mistake the numbers on the street for the actual level of support. I mean, the general is trying to say that he actually has support, but he's, of course, increasingly isolated. He's getting information from those quarters who've always supported him. And, of course, as in any country, there are those who support this emergency as well.
I think that his popularity has been going south for some time, and that the history of no movements of the opposition to Pinochet, for example, or other countries, is one that suggests that we might be able to get a unity moment from these other fractious groups, because they can be united in their opposition to Musharraf in a way that they haven't been. It's also interesting that groups, strong allies of Musharraf, like the MQM, have also criticized this particular initiative, even though they're, in many ways they see their own survival in Karachi as being tied to his regime. So I think he's getting more and more isolated. He undoubtedly feels that. Sure, people are double speaking to him, that they're saying there's some people who are criticizing him publicly and telling him privately something quite different. But he has to recognize that the earth is moving a little bit, even if the New York Times interview appeared to suggest that he was wholly out of touch.
Thank you. Okay, another question.
Hi.
Just if you say your name for the speakers.
Okay. My name is Karen Khalid. I'm a freelance journalist based in New York. My question is in reference to a comment that was made by Imran Khan on CNN last week, where he called in from an undisclosed location and made a comparison to what's happening in Pakistan right now with what happened in Iran during the Shah's leadership, essentially that the American complicity with the leader at that time united the country's moderates with the extremists and created a tide that eventually overthrew the Shah, but also resulted in what we see in Iran today, which is Islamist extremism and a very deeply rooted hatred of the United States.
Thank you. Rick, do you want to take a crack at the Shah comparison?
Well, I certainly heard it, and it's something that, as we were doing our study, that we thought of and were concerned about. I do think that the United States is deeply unpopular and in Pakistan, and there are deep-seated suspicions. I'm not sure that the complicity of the U.S. is quite as great or quite as responsible in Pakistan as we were in Iran for both creating Musharraf and then standing by him. And I just don't know. It feels like there's more, that the better parallel might well be Indonesia, where Suharto regime really had come unraveled in many, many different ways, including the military being way overextended in the business community and in the governance world rather than doing its own job. So I just don't know that it's a perfect fit, but of course there were warning signs there. And one of the things the United States should be doing is to be stating clearly that we are more humble about shaping Pakistan's future, that we really want it to be done by its people, and that we will shift our assistance from the military to the people, and also ask more of our military agreements and make it all more transparent so that we have a chance to be understood by a public which is deeply skeptical of us in Pakistan.
Actually, did you want to comment
well,
on this?
I'll just say that I don't think that the comparison it really stands between Musharraf and the Shah. Musharraf is no Shah. He's not the Shah. And I also think that the institutional balances in Pakistan are quite different from those in Iran. The religious elements in Iran, their organization is simply not matched in Pakistan. At the same time, the Pakistan Army is all important and the most viable institution in Pakistan. And even though it's heartening to hear the possibility of the U.S. shifting its attention to the people of Pakistan, the long-suffering people of Pakistan, I just don't see how the army can be kept out as a major factor, even in U.S. policy. What the Americans would be seeking to do would be to get, as has been suggested, a softer face of the military. But clearly, the military will remain the main institution in any American calculations vis-a-vis Pakistan. So I don't see how that's going to change.
I just like to add, I think there is much more openness in Pakistan, even as they put people in jail. The openness of the press, the vitality of the civil society is much greater in Pakistan than I think it was in Iran back in that era.
And clearly there's a calculation that takes them into account. Even that Asma's been, for example, and hers is far, and she's the first one to say it, far from the worst, but that she's able to issue statements, appeals, publish articles, participate in fora such as this one. Incidentally, we've lost now the connection with her, but shows that there is, and I think it's a calculated risk, and I think maybe paying off, unfortunately, better for the generals now. That you know the steam is allowed to be vented, people can speak and so on, and communicate with the outside. And that kind of is a part of the crisis management. I don't know whether it's, but there's certainly the vibrant civil society in Pakistan, which I think is the point that both of you are making. Rick, I wanted to look a little bit more at the U.S. role, though, because you know, it'd be difficult to think about what happens. I think everyone agrees it'd be difficult to think about what happens next in Pakistan without some type of decisive position evolving in the U.S. And you say right now that it's in Washington, it's been predictable, it's been rather bland, and still not decisive one way or the other. What do you see would likely change the terms of the debate in Washington? To what extent, second question, to what extent should is there any reason to believe that in the coming election that there's a breakdown on partisan lines between Democrats and Republicans on the question of Pakistan? And you know, what have the candidates really distinguished themselves, or is the Democratic leadership on the Hill really distinguished itself from the administration or the let's say the vice president's and the Pentagon's positions on this? And looking to the coming to the new FY08, you know, how much money are we really putting into Pakistan, and is it really plausible to say that we don't own the solution?
Mm-hmm. those are all good questions. Thank you. I think that there's already a great nervousness in Washington about being isolated in a country of 160 million people, that we are on a very, very narrow peninsula with a thin neck. And when we were hanging out with Musharraf, the feeling that tens of millions of people, probably a vast majority of the country, is not only opposed to Musharraf, but sees us as being his last friends. So I think that the expression of people power is clearly going to have an influence in Washington. I think that a disastrous turn or two, I think of interviews that show that Musharraf is really out of touch with the reality on the ground, all of those events are part of what's leading the State Department initially, because I assume that's where the leaks are coming from around the Secretary of State, to grant off-the-record interviews that suggest that we're now meeting with a much wider range of leaders, that the embassy is trying to reach out without looking to be impolite. So there's a lot of noise that is not yet solidified into a position of any kind. But I think it's going to be, ultimately it has to be the people power, probably followed by some sort of stupid mistake, which inevitably tyrants make in these kinds of cases, because they're really not used to being questioned, they're not used to being challenged, and we already see it in the way Musharraf is characterized in some of these interviews as being more nervous, more defensive, or less sure of himself. All of those qualities are being factored in and are beginning to get the lead users in the Washington community thinking about the post-Musharraf opportunity. On your second question of the Democrats and the Republicans, there aren't enough people in the presidential race who know anything about Pakistan to really be able to say much at this point. And the truth is that most of their advisors don't know much about Pakistan either. It's a rather small community of people in this country who really know and appreciate what's going on. And
remember, Bush couldn't even remember who was the leader of Musharraf's name at this point in the 99-2000. So.
I think all of the presidential candidates are way ahead of that this time. So we are making some modest progress, but we have a couple of structural defects here in Washington. One is that there are a very limited number of experts. There are quite a few people who have dealt with Pakistan, but almost exclusively over the years in relationship to Afghanistan. So they fly to Islamabad, and then they look to the northwest, and they move towards Afghanistan. And so that has been the optic that has driven our interpretation. So we've missed the life and reality of 120 million people. As we do that, so that's an awakening that's taking place right now, but again it's one that moves fairly fast. Senator Biden has addressed this issue because that's his niche in the presidential race, is the foreign policy expert, and others clearly will as well. Various candidates have made mistakes already in the past few months in terms of describing what we might be able to do with U.S. military power inside of Pakistan, which I think would be calamitous. But I think they've backed off the Democrats who wanted to strike that tough ground have backed off, and now I think there is a moment of reflection taking place, but it hasn't shown up in the marketplace yet. And then in terms of the money, your third part of your question, the United States has been contributing in overt funds and public spending about $2 billion a year. And we, in our study, we think it's probably matched by an almost equal amount in covert funding, but of course we don't really know. That's just what we've heard in interviews and conversations. So the $2 billion of overt assistance, almost 90% of it has really gone to the military, or at least to this regime, and so it has really been a critical piece of financial support. We're paying almost $100 million a month in coalition support funds for the Pakistani soldiers that are up in the northwest, helping with the war on terror, plus landing rights and other advantages that the Pakistani military offers to the U.S. military in the war in Afghanistan. So that's an important transfusion. Most of that money has probably been converted to the purchase of sophisticated weapons systems, including F-16 fighters, which really shows that the Pakistani military is still much more concerned with India. And so that's an argument that is really now taking a hold here in Washington, that people are saying if we're really helping Pakistan so they can help us with the war on terror, how come we're helping them arm for a prospective war against India? That doesn't make any sense. And so there is a shift taking place. The other thing that's going on right now that's somewhat new is the $750 million five-year program that for direct assistance, mostly economic assistance, into the Northwest as well of Pakistan. And that, as I understood from a conversation I had yesterday, that planning is going ahead as if nothing is happening in Pakistan right now. It's seen as something that's important and matters, and of course it takes so long to get from planning to spending that you won't see the benefits of that, but clearly that's an area of the country that not only has been underdeveloped, but has also just not received the attention from Islamabad that it needed, and so there's a huge absorptive capacity there for almost any kind of assistance.
We have a question, but you need to go to the mic, I'm afraid. He won't hear you.
It's actually not a question. I wanted to add to Rick's comment. One principal optic that was not mentioned through which any decisions about what kind of government or arrangement the United States would be able to support in Pakistan has to do with the possession of nuclear weapons. And I think throughout these years of Musharraf's tenure and going very far into the future, that is going to be a central optic. The threat of theft or use of those weapons and control of those weapons are an absolutely central ingredient to any kind of decision making that the United States is going to do with regard to Pakistan.
Thank you. And of course, even under the watch of the military, there's been substantial leakage heretofore. Rick, did you want to? Could I hear you wanting to come in on that?
I just completely agree. I think it's correct. It should be a central piece, but I think it's also we have found a very odd way to develop a mutual trust with Pakistani governments and the Pakistani people, and so we trust the Pakistani government in the strangest places where we really should, at the very least, be verifying like crazy. And then we don't trust in places where it would be good to show that we have confidence in the Pakistani people in the process. So we've had this kind of upside down view, and as this new book Deception suggests, we've been aware of a great deal, but we haven't figured out where to intervene when it really mattered, and that is part of the loss of American credibility inside of Pakistan.
Well, we're beginning to come to the end of our time. I want to see whether there are any other questions from the audience. It's time to go to the mic.
Just really quickly, this is Karen Karlicker from Freedom House. I know most of the focus in this recent conflict has been between the executive and judicial branches, but I just wanted to also clarify the role of the legislature. I know that the pro-Musharraf party has a majority, I believe, and so in the recent presidential vote, he was able to win the vote, even though some of the parties had either walked out of parliament or were abstaining from the vote. But I just wanted to also clarify the current role of the legislature, whether it is functioning or not, and if any of the speakers see any role for the legislature moving forward in this resolving the conflict.
Well, I mean, the legislature in Pakistan, again, has always been a rubber-stamping body. And yes, he has, thanks to the 2002 elections in which the mainstream parties were basically hung, drawn, if not quartered, allowed them to, I mean, his PMLQ was able to muster up enough votes to have a majority. But it was still ruling, I mean, the two-thirds he needed came with the MMA, I mean, the MMA being the religious sort of coalition, which won 11% of the popular vote but grabbed a lot more seats than it would have had the mainstream parties been allowed a chance. So yes, I mean, there was a parliament that was basically beholden to the executive, which is what exactly he wanted. And he did have a majority, but clearly the parliament was simply doing what was being asked of it. The parliament tomorrow, if it hasn't already been done, it finishes its term. Tomorrow is the 15th of November, and it will be dissolved. There are signs of an interim government. We hear the name of an interim prime minister being named. So an interim government is going to be taking over, and the general wants to hold elections on the 9th, before the 9th of January, which means that he has no intention of lifting martial law. And so the assumption is that he again wants a legislative body that will demonstrate his strength, his party's strength, and it, unfortunately, it's likely to be boycotted, this sort of an election, and even if the PMLQ sweeps the election, which it will, like the referendum of 2002, it's not going to have any credibility.
And just on that, again, the point that Aisha made before, that since we're in an irregular constitutional state, I think it's a two-thirds, not simply a majority, that would be necessary to indemnify the treason. So that also complicates the equation.
So he desperately needs that.
Yeah.
So he needs a parliament to indemnify this act. Otherwise, it's not going to be lifted. You have to understand that. We know that from experience.
I think one of the greater challenges for the political parties is to think beyond a boycott and to take energy from some of the no movements, some of the resistance movements, electoral resistance movements that have really brought great global attention in other places. And I think that would be a much more demanding scenario for them to pursue, because a boycott could easily end up with this sort of totally unrepresentative process, which in the final analysis could then be used to authenticate some illegal measures. So it's very tough, but short of a national unity government, coming up with some alternative to a boycott could be one of the best ways to express the public discontent.
I'd like to see. Do you have one more question? Okay.
I'm Brittany Gleixner-Hyatt from the Social Science Research Council. I just quickly wanted to know if you could comment on what you think the capacity of a civilian government would be coming into power, having to check such huge forces like a military institution that historically has been so strong, and in addition, international forces which have played such a large hand in this government, to the point that we're talking about what their interests are and how they should deal with their weapons in this country. So what enormous powers are they going to have to check, and what is their capacity going to be, and how difficult is that going to be, and the trajectory, the history here, how is that going to be played out in a civilian government? Is it going to be able to produce a change, especially with Benazir?
Any civilian government that may emerge from a relatively free and fair election will have to work with the military very closely to combat the extremist problem, to take care of many of the other things that need to be taken care of in Pakistan in terms of law and order, security issues. So there is no possibility of the military not continuing to be a dominant part of the equation, which was one of the reasons why Washington was thinking in terms of Musharraf presidency and a Benazir popularly based party backing him. Well, that's looking increasingly unlikely. But you will need a civilian government with a sort of support base, and the chances are that we're going to have a very fragmented electorate. I mean, it's going to be if not a hung parliament, then a fragmented parliament. And the presidency the eyes will go on the presidency, whoever the president is, because the president will have the power, and the presidency will be stronger if the parliament is fragmented, if they're at sixes and sevens. But in any equation, the presidency is going to be important, and the military. And so the civilian government will simply be providing. I mean, and the point is that Pakistan cannot come out of a structural imbalance it's had for years in all of a sudden. It's going to have to be a process. So whatever will happen in terms of the next few months, the relevance of the presidency, whoever may be in it, and the military has to be acknowledged. And the parliament will simply be the cheerleading institution that it has been, if not a rubber stamping institution, for a bit. But providing the support base to the presidency and the military to carry out the operations that have to be carried out. Why it's so important to hold elections and have a mass-based movement backing these two institutions is that Pakistanis have been in self-denial about this problem that they face on their borders or inside their borders in the northwestern frontier. It's all too easy to say that it's an American war. It's a war for America, and unfortunately a lot of people believe that. And I think Musharraf has been trying to suggest that it's time that the Pakistanis realize that this is for themselves, but he has not been successful, nor for that matter the party that has supported him. The PMLQ, we know that there are elements in the PMLQ who are actually sympathetic to some of these groups, the militant groups. They were to the Lal Masjid Brigade. So I think there's been a credibility issue. Pakistanis believe that this war on terrorism it's not really their war. It's not really a war for power in Islamabad, but a war carried out for America in Afghanistan. So I think that's why you need an election and you need a credible civilian government which can back the presidency and the military to combat that. Over the years, if Pakistan is able to go through a complete process and there are regular elections, then yes, parliament will be strengthened and you will see stronger political parties. But historically, that's not been the case. And given the political divisions and the divisions in the opposition, the chances are that you're going to have a fairly fragmented vote in the next election.
Just as a closing thought, I'm a little bit more hopeful that this crisis could produce more change than was just suggested. I think it is a country which has a lot of capability. It has a lot of talent. Many of the technocrats have been highly frustrated by the insertion of military people in virtually all the top jobs inside of the government down to the provinces. Clearly, there has to be a shift to the provinces. It's not going to be able to be, the development of the country is not going to happen strictly out of Islamabad. That's something that there should be a great emphasis on, and that's one way to de-emphasize the military as well. And if there is an opportunity for the U.S. to show that it can broaden its alliance between a military-to-military relationship, one that goes between the American people and the Pakistani people, and that's the kind of confidence building assistance that could help the Pakistani people get out of this governance prison that they've been in for most of their history. So I think there are opportunities here. It doesn't mean that they're going to happen, but I think that that the U.S. can be catalytic in a constructive way. There's clearly a lot of pent-up demand inside of Pakistan that we could align ourselves with.
I do think that it's important to make the distinction between military rule. I do think that Pakistan will move towards civilian rule. But given the institutional balance, I think that we need to understand the distinction between military rule and military dominance. Military dominance will remain. Military rule will end.
Yeah, I think the military may be a little bit more of a paper tiger than just suggested. I think there could be an opening here, and it depends a lot on how this crisis unfolds.
Yeah,
but if there are problems in the Punjab area and the military does not deal with them skillfully, then an opening could appear that could lead to much greater change, and that's where you have to have a really skillful pilot.
Not sure everyone is in agreement in the room here, Rick, that the military is a
paper tiger.
It's got a very real tiger.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying they're there, but I think they're a little bit more. There's a little bit more smoke and mirrors than they get credit for.
Yeah. Listen, I would like to thank all of our participants, and I'm sorry we lost Asma after about the first 40 minutes or so. The Open Society Institute initially issued a strong statement condemning the martial law-like emergency rule and calling for the release of all of those under detention, those who are closely connected to us, of whom there are many and increasing numbers, and those who have otherwise been arrested. we want to and intend to keep attention to this matter, and I'm really grateful that we had the benefit of Aisha Jalal coming from Boston today, and Rick as well, and Anil on the panel. We're helping a delegation from the IFJ to visit, because we didn't at all really talk about the situation in which the media find themselves, but there will be next week a mission drawing on significant resources from South Asian journalists to Pakistan with the Pakistan Federation, PFUJ rather. So there are a number of elements to this. We're going to keep attention focused on it, and we're looking for opportunities with all of you to do so. And if you share your ideas with us, our own efforts will benefit from it. So once again, Anil Kahan, Rick Barton, Aisha Jalal, thank you very much.
Thank you.